This is the Poetry Foundation's Essential American Poets podcast. Essential American Poets is an online audio poetry collection. The poets in the collection were selected in 2006 by Donald Hall when he was poet laureate. Recordings of the poets he selected are available online at poetryfoundation.org and poetryarchive.org. In this edition of the podcast, we'll hear poems by Elizabeth Bishop. Born in 1911, Elizabeth Bishop was an only child. Her father died before she was a year old, and her mother was institutionalized for mental illness when Bishop was 5 years old. Bishop never saw her mother again. Brought up by a succession of relatives in Nova Scotia and then Massachusetts, Bishop attended Vassar College, where she connected with the poet Marianne Moore, who would greatly influence Bishop's poetry. Bishop's early experience of dislocation was a pattern that repeated throughout her life. The title of her 1965 book, Questions of Travel, could stand as an epigraph for a lifetime of wandering. After graduation, she traveled widely in Europe and North Africa, living off a small family legacy. At midlife, she settled in Brazil for 14 years before ultimately returning to the United States. Bishop worked as a painter as well as a poet, and her verse, like visual art, is known for its ability to capture scenes with vivid detail. Her experience of different landscapes makes for precise, subtle impressions of the physical world in her poetry. Bishop was a perfectionist who did not write prolifically. Instead, she spent long periods of time polishing her work. "I'm not interested in big-scale work as such," she once told her closest literary friend, Robert Lowell. "Something needn't be large to be good." During her lifetime, Elizabeth Bishop was a respected yet somewhat obscure figure in the world of American literature. Never one to seek the limelight, her profile nevertheless increased in her final years as her poetry was recognized by major awards and she began to give more readings. Since her death in 1979, many critics have referred to her as one of the most important American poets of the past century. The following poem was recorded in New York City in 1947.
Roosters. At 4 o'clock, in the gunmetal blue dark, we hear the first crow of the first cock, just below the gunmetal blue window, and immediately there is an echo, off in the distance, then one from the backyard fence, then one with horrible insistence, grates like a wet match from the broccoli patch, flares, and all over town begins to catch. Cries galore come from the water closet door, from the dropping plastered hen house floor, where in the blue blur there are rustling wives admire, the roosters brace their cruel feet and glare with stupid eyes, while from their beaks there rise the uncontrolled traditional cries. Deep from protruding chests in green gold medals dressed, plan to command and terrorize the rest, the many wives who lead hens' lives of being courted and despised. Deep from raw throats a senseless order floats all over town. A rooster gloats over our beds from rusty iron sheds and fences made from old bedsteads. Over our churches where the tin rooster perches. Over our little wooden northern houses. Making sallies from all the muddy alleys, marking out maps like Rand McNally's. Glass-headed pins, oil golds and copper greens. Anthracite blues, alizarins. Each one an active displacement in perspective. Each screaming, "This is where I live." Each screaming, "Get up, stop dreaming." Roosters, what are you projecting? You whom the Greeks elected to shoot at on a post, who struggled when sacrificed. You whom they labeled very combative. What right have you to give commands and tell us how to live? Cry here and here, and wake us here where our unwanted love, conceit, and war. The crown of red set on your little head is charged with all your fighting blood. Yes, that excrescence makes a most virile presence, plus all that vulgar beauty of iridescence. Now in midair by twos they fight each other, down comes the first flame feather. And one is flying with raging heroism, defying even the sensation of dying. And one has fallen, but still above the town his torn out, bloodied feathers drift down. And what he sung, no matter. He is flung on the gray ash heap, lies in dung with his dead wives, with open bloody eyes, while those metallic feathers oxidize. St. Peter's sin was worse than that of Magdalene, whose sin was of the flesh alone. Of spirit, Peter's, falling beneath the flares among the servants and officers. Old holy sculpture could set it all together in one small scene, past and future. Christ stands amazed. Peter, two fingers raised to surprised lips, both as if dazed. But in between, a little cock is seen, carved on a dim column in the travertine. Explained by Gallus Canet, Flate Patris, underneath it. There is inescapable hope, the pivot. Yes, and there Peter's tears run down our Chanticleer's sides and gem his spurs. Tear-encrusted, thick as a medieval relic, he waits. Poor Peter, heartsick, still cannot guess those cockadoodles yet might bless. His dreadful rooster come to mean forgiveness. A new weather vane on basilica and barn, and that outside the Lateran there would always be a bronze cock on a porphyry pillar, so the people and the Pope might see that even the prince of the apostles long since had been forgiven, and to convince all the assembly that deny, deny, deny is not all the rooster's cry. In the morning, a low light is floating in the backyard, gilding from underneath the broccoli, leaf by leaf. How could the night have come to grief? Gilding the tiny floating swallow's belly and lines of pink cloud in the sky. The day's preamble, like wandering lines in marble. The cocks are now almost inaudible. The sun climbs in, following to see the end, faithful as enemy or friend.
The following poems were recorded at the Library of Congress in 1974.
Crusoe in England. A new volcano has erupted, the papers say, and last week I was reading where some ship saw an island being born. At first a breath of steam 10 miles away, and then a black fleck, basalt probably, rose in the mate's binoculars and caught on the horizon like a fly. They named it. But my poor old island's still unrediscovered, unrenameable. None of the books has ever got it right. Well, I had 52 miserable small volcanoes I could climb with a few slithery strides. Volcanoes dead as ash heaps. I used to sit on the edge of the highest one and count the others, standing up, naked and leaden, with their heads blown off. I'd think that if they were the size I thought volcanoes should be, then I'd become a giant. And if I had become a giant, I couldn't bear to think what size the goats and turtles were, or the gulls, or the overlapping rollers. A glittering hexagon of rollers closing and closing in, but never quite. Glittering and glittering, though the sky was mostly overcast. My island seemed to be a sort of cloud dump. All the hemisphere's leftover clouds arrived and hung above the craters. Their parched throats were hot to touch. Was that why it rained so much? And why sometimes the whole place hissed? The turtles lumbered by, high-domed, hissing like tea kettles. And I'd have given years or taken a few for any sort of kettle, of course. The folds of lava running out to sea would hiss. I'd turn, and then they'd prove to be more turtles. The beaches were all lava, variegated, black, red, and white, and gray. The marbled colors made a fine display. And I had waterspouts. Oh, half a dozen at a time, far out, they'd come and go, advancing and retreating, their heads in cloud, their feet in moving patches of scuffed up white. Glass chimneys, flexible, attenuated, sacerdotal beings of glass. I watched the water spiral up in them like smoke. Beautiful, yes, but not much company. I often gave way to self-pity. Do I deserve this? I suppose I must. I wouldn't be here otherwise. Was there a moment when I actually chose this? I don't remember, but there could have been. What's wrong about self-pity anyway? With my legs dangling down familiarly over a crater's edge, I told myself pity should begin at home. So the more pity I felt, the more I felt at home. The sun set in the sea. The same odd sun rose from the sea, and there was one of it and one of me. The island had one kind of everything, one tree snail, a bright violet blue with a thin shell, crept over everything, over the one variety of tree, a sooty scrub affair. Snail shells lay under these in drifts, and at a distance you'd swear that they were beds of irises. There was one kind of berry, a dark red. I tried it one by one and hours apart. Subacid and not bad, no ill effects, and so I made home brew. I drink the awful, fizzy, stinging stuff that went straight to my head and play my homemade flute. I think it had the weirdest scale on earth, and dizzy, whoop and dance among the goats. Homemade, homemade, but aren't we all? I felt a deep affection for the smallest of my island industries. No, not exactly, since the smallest was a miserable philosophy. Because I didn't know enough. Why didn't I know enough of something? Greek drama or astronomy? The books I'd read were full of blanks. The poems, well, I tried reciting to my iris beds. They flash upon that inward eye, which is the bliss of what? One of the first things that I did when I got back was look it up. The island smelled of goat and guano. The goats were white, so were the gulls, and both too tame, or else they thought I was a goat too, or a gull. Bah, 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 and shriek, 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 bah, shriek, bah. I still can't shake them from my ears, they're hurting now. The questioning shrieks, the equivocal replies, over a ground of hissing rain and hissing ambulating turtles got on my nerves. When all the gulls flew up at once, they sounded like a big tree in a strong wind, its leaves. I'd shut my eyes and think about a tree, an oak, say, with real shade somewhere. I'd heard of cattle getting island sick. I thought the goats were. One billy goat would stand on the volcano I'd christened Mont d'Espoir, or Mount Despair. I'd time enough to play with names, and bleat and bleat and sniff the air. I grabbed his beard and look at him. His pupils, perpendicular, narrowed up and expressed nothing, or a little malice. I got so tired of the very colors. One day I dyed a baby goat bright red with my red berries just to see something a little different, and then his mother wouldn't recognize him. Dreams were the worst. Of course I dreamed of food and love, but they were pleasant rather than otherwise. But then I'd dream of things like slitting a baby's throat, mistaking it for a baby goat. I'd have nightmares of other islands stretching away from mine. Infinities of islands, islands spawning islands like frogs' eggs turning into polywogs of islands. Knowing that I had to live on each and every one eventually for ages, registering their flora, their fauna, their geography. Just when I thought I couldn't stand it another minute longer, Friday came. Accounts of that have everything all wrong. Friday was nice. Friday was nice, and we were friends. If only he had been a woman. I wanted to propagate my kind, and so did he, I think, poor boy. He'd pet the baby goats sometimes and race with them or carry one around. Pretty to watch. He had a pretty body. And then one day they came and took us off. Now I live here, another island that doesn't seem like one, but who decides? My blood was full of them, my brain bred islands. But that archipelago has petered out. I'm old. I'm bored, too, drinking my real tea, surrounded by uninteresting lumber. The knife there on the shelf, it reeked of meaning like a crucifix. It lived. How many years did I beg it, implore it not to break? I knew each nick and scratch by heart, the bluish blade, the broken tip, the lines of wood grain on the handle. Now it won't look at me at all. The living soul has dribbled away. My eyes rest on it and pass on. The local museums asked me to leave everything to them, the flute, the knife, the shriveled shoes, my shedding goatskin trousers, moths have got in the fur, the parasol that took me such a time remembering the way the ribs should go. It still will work, but folded up looks like a plucked and skinny fowl. How can anyone want such things? And Friday, my dear Friday, died of measles 17 years ago come March. This one will have to be changed, as you see, somehow. I don't know how at the end, but I'll read it the way it is now. It's called Filling Station. Oh, but it's dirty, this little filling station, oil-soaked, oil-permeated to a disturbing overall black translucency. Be careful with that match. Father wears a dirty, oil-soaked monkey suit that cuts him under the arms, and several quick and saucy and greasy sons assist him. It's a family filling station, all quite thoroughly dirty. Do they live in the station? It has a cement porch behind the pumps, and on it a set of crush and grease impregnated wickerwork. On the wicker sofa, a dirty dog, quite comfy. Some comic books provide the only note of color, of certain color. They lie upon a big dim doily draping a tabouret, part of the set, beside a big hirsute begonia. Why the extraneous plant? Why the tabouret? Why, oh why, the doily? Embroidered in daisy stitch with marguerites, I think, and heavy with gray crochet. Somebody embroidered the doily. Somebody waters the plant, or oils it, maybe. Somebody arranges the rows of cans so that they softly say, so, to high-strung automobiles, somebody loves us all. I'm afraid that's wasted. No. This is a Nova Scotian poem about the east coast of Nova Scotia called At the Fish Houses, south of Halifax, where it's a very rugged coastline. Although it's a cold evening, down by one of the fish houses, an old man sits netting. His net, in the gloaming, almost invisible, a dark purple brown, and his shuttle worn and polished. The air smells so strong of codfish it makes one's nose run and one's eyes water. The five fish houses have steeply peaked roofs, and narrow cleated gangplanks slant up to storerooms in the gables for the wheelbarrows to be pushed up and down on. All is silver, the heavy surface of the sea swelling slowly as if considering spilling over is opaque, but the silver of the benches, the lobster pots and masts scattered among the wild jagged rocks is of an apparent translucence, like the small old buildings with an emerald moss growing on their shoreward walls. The big fish tubs are completely lined with layers of beautiful herring scales, and the wheelbarrows are similarly plastered with creamy, iridescent coats of mail, with small iridescent flies crawling on them. Up on the little slope behind the houses, set in the sparse, bright sprinkle of grass, is an ancient wooden capstan, cracked, with two long bleached handles and some melancholy stains like dried blood where the ironwork has rusted. The old man accepts a lucky strike. He was a friend of my grandfather. We talk of the decline in the population of codfish and herring while he waits for the herring boat to come in. There are sequins on his vest and on his thumb. He has scraped the scales, the principal beauty, from unnumbered fish with that black old knife, the blade of which is almost worn away. Down at the water's edge, at the place where they haul up the boats, up the long ramp descending into the water, thin silver tree trunks are laid horizontally across the gray stones, down and down at intervals of 4 or 5 feet. Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, element bearable to no mortal, to fish and to seals. One seal particularly I've seen here evening after evening. He was curious about me. He was interested in music. Like me, a believer in total immersion. So I used to sing him Baptist hymns. I also sang "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God." He stood up in the water and regarded me steadily, moving his head a little. Then he would disappear, then suddenly emerge almost in the same spot with a sort of shrug, as if it were against his better judgment. Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, the clear, gray, icy water. Back behind us, the dignified tall firs begin, bluish, associating with their shadows. A million Christmas trees stand waiting for Christmas. The water seems suspended above the rounded gray and blue-gray stones. I've seen it over and over, the same sea, the same, slightly, indifferently swinging above the stones, icily free above the stones, and then the world. If you should dip your hand in, your wrist would ache immediately. Your bones would begin to ache, and your hand would burn as if the water were a transmutation of fire that feeds on stones and burns with a dark gray flame. If you tasted it, it would first taste bitter, then briny, then surely burn your tongue. It is like what we imagine knowledge to be, dark, salt, clear, moving, utterly free, drawn from the cold, hard mouth of the world, derived from the rocky breasts forever, flowing and drawn. And since our knowledge is historical, flowing and flown.
That was Elizabeth Bishop, recorded at the Library of Congress in 1974 and used by permission of Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. You have been listening to the Essential American Poets podcast, produced by the Poetry Foundation in collaboration with poetryarchive.org. To learn more about Elizabeth Bishop and other Essential American poets, and to hear more poetry, go to poetryfoundation.org.